this today. But before we get into chapter 36, let's take a look at a review from the last time. First of all, remember from chapter 34 that the sons of Jacob turned on and went against the city of Shechem. But before we get into chapter 36, let's take a look at a review from the last time. First of all, remember from chapter 34 that the sons of Jacob turned on and went against the city of Shechem because the prince of that particular city had violated one of Jacob's daughter, Dinah. And the sons actually end up plundering the city and they slaughtered the men. They set a bad example to the surrounding nations, the Canaanites that were around the city of Shechem, instead of putting it all into God's hands. In chapter 35, because they had plundered the city and taken also the idols that were in the city, God instructed the sons of Jacob to bury the idols that they had, to put on clothes to worship him, and eventually Jacob did go to Bethel to worship God. So to put on righteous clothes, worship him, in other words, pure worship. In chapter 35, we see that Jacob renewed his vows at Bethel, vows that he had made earlier to God, and God reaffirmed the blessings to Jacob. But this time, with the reaffirming of the blessings, God made a promise to Jacob that a nation and a company of nations would come from his descendants. Where we left off in Genesis chapter 35, verse 29, from the last Bible study, we see that Isaac died, and he was gathered, all of the family gathered together, and Esau and Jacob came together and buried Isaac. So that brings us to the story of Esau, which is chapter 36. Chapter 36 is a history of Esau, who became a powerful chief. It's interesting, the nation of Edom, who were the descendants of Esau, became a powerful kingdom right away after Esau left the homeland. Whereas the children of Israel would not become a powerful nation until many years later. Many, many years, even after they came out of Egypt. So Esau becomes a powerful chief and nation right away. Verse number 1. Now this is the genealogy of Esau, who is Edom. The nation that became known as Edom were the descendants of Esau. Esau became known as Edom. Now, the genealogy of Esau is important for a couple of reasons. Number one, to show that he is not forgotten. He's one of the patriarchs. He's one of Isaac's sons. But also, the genealogy is important because his descendants, the descendants of Esau, would come into contact with Israel throughout Israel's history. From the ancient times, even to today, modern times, the descendants of Esau are coming into contact with the descendants of Isaac. We see here in verse number 1, the phrase, Esau, who is Edom. This is repeated several times in chapter 36 as a repeated emphasis. Again, Esau is important because they interact with the children of Israel so much throughout history. Here's a map to show you where Edom was located. It's located to the east of the land of Canaan. Here's the land of Canaan, the promised land. There's the Dead Sea. Here's where Edom was located, to the east. Down here is Arabia. We're going to see in verse number 8 that Mount Seir, which was a famous landmark back in the ancient times, in verse number 8, was located in the land of Edom. Edom is what we would call southern Jordan today. You've heard of the nation of Jordan. Edom is located in the southern part of what is known as Jordan today. And it includes the famous city of Petra. All of you have heard of Petra, those of you that have been in the church for many years. Here again is Edom on a map of the Middle East. And you can see just below this, where Edom is marked, here's the city of Petra. Again, Here's the promised land, Canaan, the Dead Sea, and here's where the nation of Edom was located. And again, that includes the famous city of Petra. I've got a snapshot here of a portion of the main street and a gate from ancient Petra, which is located, was located in the nation of Edom. And you can see at one time it was a flourishing civilization. And it was a powerful nation, especially in those early days when Esau was a powerful chief. Verse number 2. Esau took his wives from the daughters of Canaan. That was not a good idea. We've seen this before in the scriptures. Ada, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and Ahaloboma, the daughter of Anah, the daughter of Zibeon the Hivite. Verse number 3, he also took his wife Basemath, Ishmael's daughter, sister of Naboth. So Esau took Canaanite wives, but he also took one of Ishmael's daughters as a wife as well. Verse number 2, we see that he took wives from the daughters of Canaan. Going back to Genesis chapter 26, 35, we see that those daughters were a grief of mind to Isaac and Jacob. Why? Because they were pagan women, and the pagans did detestable things. Both Isaac and Rebekah grieved over Esau's Canaanite wives. But also we see in verse number 3 that he married one of Ishmael's daughters. This would tie Esau's descendants with Ishmael's descendants. And they both mixed and intermingled and intermarried and are generally known as Arab peoples today. And throughout history, again, this intermingling of Ishmael's descendants with Esau's, again, known, generally speaking, as Arab peoples. Verse number 4. Now Ada bore Eliphaz to Esau, and Basemath bore Reuah. Verse number 5. And Ahaloboma bore Jeush, Jalam, and Korah. These were the sons of Esau who were born to him in the land of Canaan. Now, throughout chapter 36, there's a whole listing of names of descendants of various of these sons. I'm not going to go through the names of all of these sons who became chiefs and kings in the land of Edom. We're just going to point out some of the important ones as far as interacting with the nation of Israel is concerned. So these are some of the sons that were born to the in the land of Canaan. 5 sons from verses 4 and 5 were born to Esau in the land of Canaan. This is interesting, this particular phrase, in the land of Canaan. The Bible Knowledge Commentary points this out. This contrasts sharply with Jacob, whose children were born out of the land and who moved into the land. So remember, Jacob's children were born in the land of Mesopotamia, where he was working for Laban. And then they moved into the promised land, whereas Esau's children were born in the promised land and moved out. The Bible Knowledge Commentary adds this, Israel would understand the importance of this because she often struggled with the Edomites. They moved out of the promised land, but Israel struggled with them and fought with them throughout their history. And that continues on today. Verse number 6. Then Esau took his wives, his sons, his daughters, and all the persons. You'll notice that I have all highlighted here in verse number 6 various times. All the persons of his household, his cattle, all his animals, all his goods, which he had gained in the land of Canaan, and went to a country away from the presence of his brethren Jacob. He went east from the promised land. Again, this shows that Esau was a rich man, similar to what we read about Job. The wealth was presented with the animals that you owned back in those ancient times. That was a way of measuring wealth. Esau was a wealthy man when he moved to where Edom would be located. Verse number 7 describes this. For their possessions, Jacob and Esau together, Their possessions were too great for them to dwell together, and the land where they were strangers could not support them because of their livestock. This corresponds to what we read about in chapter 13. Abraham and Lot had so many possessions that the land could not hold them both. And Lot separated and went eastward towards Sodom and Gomorrah. So this happened as well later on with Jacob and Esau. They had so many possessions, they had to separate. Esau goes east. Esau, who became known as Edom, becomes a powerful kingdom as Esau left Canaan, and he would be for many years. Again, Esau and Edom become powerful right away, whereas the children of Israel, they go to Egypt. They're there all that time, come out of Egypt, wander for 40 years, then finally come into the Promised Land. They become a nation, a powerful nation, much later in history, whereas Esau and Edom is powerful right away. Verse number 8. So Esau dwelt in Mount Seir. Esau is Edom. Again, this is pointed out and repeated. And again, as the children of Israel are reading this now, when they're coming into the Promised Land, they're understanding who the Edomites are. And unfortunately, too many times they were enemies. This phrase, Esau is Edom, is repeated. And I ask the question, why? Expositors adds this. The solution lies in the future importance of Edom during the later periods of Israel's history, because they fought so much. But it even goes farther than that. As in the book of Obadiah, Edom became a small picture for Israel's relationship to other nations at large. In the future, talking about the millennium, in the future reign of the Messianic king, Edom would once again, as in the days of David, be a part of his kingdom. Here's a prophecy of the future in Obadiah chapter 21. It says, the saviors, or the teachers, the helpers, the saviors shall come to Mount Zion, Jerusalem, to judge the mountains of Esau. In other words, the descendants of Esau. And the kingdom shall be the Lord's. So this is showing in the kingdom that the descendants of Esau, they're going to be taught the right way in the kingdom. Verse number 9. This is the genealogy of Esau, the father of the Edomites in Mount Seir. These are the names of Esau's sons. Eliphaz, the son of Ada, the wife of Esau, and Reuel, the son of Basemath, the wife of Esau. Verse number 11. You might recognize these names as we read them, Job's friends, in the book of Job. The sons of Eliphaz were Teman, Omar, Zepho, Gatam, and Kenaz. Eliphaz, verse number 10, was the son of the Canaanite wife. Teman is the grandson of Esau. Teman would become a chief tribe of Edom. And you can find that in Obadiah 9, Obadiah verse number 9. Teman, the name Teman, this as history rolled on, and we fast forward through history, the name gets changed around, the vowels are changed during the centuries, and the name Ottoman Turks, Ottoman from Teman, the Ottomans became known as the Turks. A large part of the Turks appear to be Edomites. Now, for those of you that have been around for a long time and you remember the booklet, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that Mr. Armstrong wrote many, many years ago, he has a couple of pages, I believe it's page 38 and 39, where he addresses that Edom, a large part of the Edomites, a large part of the Turks appear to be Edomites. So that's why Teman is important. Teman was also the name of a chief city, a district of Edom, and was probably near the border of Edom. The Ottoman Turks, for those of you that aren't familiar with history, became a very, very powerful nation in the time of the Middle Ages. And they virtually controlled all of the Middle East, virtually until World War I. When World War I happened, they lost their power. But they were a a ruling power in the Middle East for many, many years. Again, verse number 11, we see the name Eliphaz. Word commentary adds this. Eliphaz, Job's comforter, Job 2, verse number 11, is described as a Temanite. So most likely, the Eliphaz and Teman that are mentioned in Job chapter 2, verse number 11, are descendants of this particular individual listed in verse number 11. Descendants from Eliphaz, Temanites. Again, they were Edomites. Haley's commentary adds this, Eliphaz and Teman are named in the book of Job. This chapter, chapter 36, may supply the setting for the book of Job. Why? Because what Job was involved with was the descendants of Esau and lived in that particular territory as well. Haley's adds this, names and places mentioned in the book of Job seem to give it a setting among the descendants of Esau. And again, I mentioned that during my message today. Going back to Job chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, the last part. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. This man was the greatest of all of the people of the east. Again, east of Palestine, exactly where Esau went and became known as Edom. Haley's adds this, the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament scriptures, in a postscript, following ancient tradition, identified Job with Jobab, the second king of Edom. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brunt. Well, let's see. I thought I had Jameson coming up next, but I don't. Here's the scripture, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit. Genesis chapter 36, verse 33. And when Bela died, Jobab, the son of Zerah of Bozrah, reigned in his place. In other words, became a king. Here's Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Jobab, the son of Zerah, the grandson of Esau, is in the Septuagint addition to the book of Job, identified with this patriarch. So again, Haley's and Job, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown are both confirming this, that from the Septuagint, that's who Jobab was, a descendant of Esau. So this is what it would look like if this particular king was Job. Esau, then Reuel, then his son was Zerah, and then from verse 33 of chapter 36, King Jobab. So we don't know exactly, because it's not said in the Bible, whether this was Job. He might be that king and he might not have been. What we do know is that Job was a great man, he had great wealth, and he was connected and came into contact with descendants of Esau, because his friends were descendants of Esau. So that's why this particular book, this particular chapter, sets the setting for the book of Job. For a period of time, some of the Edomites, as descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, likely continued to worship the true God, because they were descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which gives us some insight to the religious understanding that Job and his friends displayed. You know, it says in chapter 1, verse number 1, he was a righteous man, and he followed God. Well, why is that? Well, that would make sense if he was a descendant of Esau and a descendant of Abraham and Isaac as well. Okay, another quote from Haley's. The book has the atmosphere of very primitive times and seems to have its setting among the early tribes of Abraham. The book of Job it's talking about, along the northern border of Arabia, about contemporary with Israel's sojourn in Egypt. In other words, while Israel was in Egypt was when these events were taking place with Job. Again, aid to Bible commentary says, Job lived in the land of Uz about the time that his distant cousins, the 12 tribes of Israel, were in slavery in Egypt. Here's another map for you. Expositors adds this. It seems that the land of Uz might have been the name of the region east of Palestine, including the Edomites and adjacent tribes. So this land was somewhere in here. Again, to the east of Palestine, and most likely it's in that area where Job lived. Again, where Edom was located also. Okay, we'll move along now to another descendant of Esau that would come in contact with Israel. Verse number 12. Now Timnah was the concubine of Eliphaz, Esau's son, and she bore Amalek to Eliphaz. These were the sons of Adah, Esau's wife. And again, I'm just pointing out some of the important descendants of Esau. Teman was one, who most likely became the Ottoman Turks. Amalek is another. Amalek and his descendants come into contact with Israel all throughout their history, even today. Amalek is the grandson of Esau, father of the Amalekites. Hales adds this, they, the Amalekites, were a wandering tribe, nomadic peoples, centering mainly about Kadesh and the northern part of the Sinai Peninsula, roaming in wide circles, even into Judah, into the far east. They were wanderers, nomads, and they wandered around in that area. The Amalekites were the first to attack Israel after their departure from Egypt. This was the beginning of their warfare with their cousins, the Israelites. When Israel came out of Egypt, crossed through the Red Sea, and Pharaoh and all his chariots were drowned in the Red Sea, the Israelites came out onto the land. They began to move forward. Not too long after that, the Amalekites attacked them. They're cousins. Here's the scripture, Exodus 17, verse number 8. Now Amalek came and fought with Israel in Rephidim. And Amalek's attack on Israel led to a prophecy against them by God. And that's also in chapter 17 and verse 16. For he said, the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. And the Amalekites had a history of fighting with Israel all throughout their years. And that continues on today. Some rabbinical schools, and you can find this in our literature, even going back to Plain Truth articles and literature that we have today. Some rabbinical schools in Israel teach that the Palestinian Arabs, the main adversaries of the modern Israeli state, are Amalekites. The population of Jordan is heavily Palestinian. And many of the Palestinians in Jordan and Israel adds validity that they are of Edomite descent. So, again, many of the rabbinical schools in Israel say that the Palestinian Arabs, the ones that are the most, that fight the most against the Jews, are descendants of Amalek. And that would make sense, given the history of the Amalekites fighting with Israel, and it continues on today. Cousins fighting against each other. You know, and that goes back to going back to Abraham and, you know, in Hagar, and, you know, all the family history was one of fighting amongst each other. Here's another map for you. Again, Edom and Esau is located down here to the south of the Dead Sea and along that, in that area. And here's where the Amalekites were located. Again, this is the Sinai Peninsula. Here's Egypt. So the Israelites would cross into this area and wander in the wilderness of Sinai. And the Amalekites were the first to attack them when they crossed, came over out of the Red Sea. Again, their cousins. Now these were the sons of Reuel, Nahath, Zerah, Shemna, and Mizah. And again, there's all these names, and I'm not going to go through all these names because I've already mentioned the ones that are the important ones as far as the history of Israel is concerned. But Israel would come into contact with these descendants throughout their history. That's why this was important for them. When Moses put this together and the Israelites are reading this as they go through the Promised Land, they realize who these people are and where they're descended from. So it was, in a way, it was more important for them than it is even for us today. There's a repetition in verses 15 through 19 of Esau's sons, and they're all called chiefs. In fact, chiefs occurs 42 times in this chapter. And as the Bible Knowledge Commentary points out, a picture of Esau as an overlord is emerging. They were powerful from the time that he left the promised land, and they would be for many, many years. And they were called chiefs, and some of them were called kings. And we'll get into that here in a few moments. Here's a listing of all these chiefs, verses 15 through 19. I'm not going to read all of these, but you can see all of these chiefs. There's Chief Teman that we talked about earlier. There's Chief Amalek in verse number 16, and all the other chiefs that were descended from Esau. Verse number 19, the summary of this. These were the sons of Esau, who is Edom, and these were their chiefs. Verse number 20 through 30 is a list of the sons of Seir, the Horite. And this would be important for the Israelites as well as they were reading this, because the Horites and the Edomites mixed together. The Horites were the people that lived in that area when Esau came in and conquered. And they began to mix together, the descendants of Esau, with the sons of the Horites. And they would mix together and become known as Edomites. And there's a listing in verses 20 through 30 of all of their sons. 2 Chronicles chapter 25 calls the sons of Seir Edomites. So again, they intermingled, intermarried, and they became known as Edomites as well. Again, important for the children of Israel. Here's the listing here of all the sons of Seir, the Horite. And finally, in verse number 20, it says, these were the chiefs of the Horites according to their chiefs in the land of Seir. And they became known as Edomites. Verse number 31 now through 32 through 39 shows the listing of the kings of Edom. Again, they were powerful back in those days. Even before any king reigned, long before a king was over the children of Israel, there was kings in Edom. Expositors adds this. This verse presupposes a knowledge of the kingship in Israel, or at least the anticipation of the kingship. So verse 31 says, these were the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the children of Israel. Word commentary adds this. Edom became a part of David's empire. Though it was older, having kings before Israel shows that the older did serve the younger. Remember, there was the prophecy back in Genesis chapter 25 that Esau, would serve his younger brother Jacob. Eventually David, when he became king, conquered the nation of Edom. The Edomites, the older, eventually served the younger, the descendants of Jacob, through David. That prophecy was fulfilled through David. Here's the prophecy. I have it actually written here of Esau and Jacob, Genesis 25:23. And the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body. One shall be stronger than the other, and the older, the descendants of Esau, shall serve the younger, the descendants of Jacob. And that would happen during the time of David. Now we have the listing, verses 32 through 39, of all these kings of Edom. And again, I'll point out in verse 33, here's this Jobab again, the son of Zerah of Bozrah, reigned in his place. Possibly could have been Job, we don't know, but we do know that he was, again, he was powerful, and he did live in the vicinity of the descendants of Edom. And again, here's another summary verse, again, of all these chiefs. Last part of verse 43, these were the chiefs of Edom, according to their dwelling places, in the land of their possession. Esau was the father of the Edomites. It's been repeated over and over again, and the children of Israel were learning this. Nelson's Study Bible, although Esau is not the heir of God's everlasting covenant with the family of Abraham, God still did bless his family. They too became a nation. You know, Esau did not receive the majority of the promises, did he? But chapter 36 shows that he was a powerful nation. He had kings and he had chiefs. And they actually had kings and chiefs before Israel did. Bible Knowledge Commentary, Esau was thus great, a powerful overlord, the father of the Edomites over clans and regions with 11 chiefs descended from him. Isaac's promises to Esau were thus fulfilled. And by being away from Jacob, he was shaking the yoke of his brother from his neck. That was another prophecy, going back to chapter 27, verses 39 and 40. Then Isaac, his father, remember Esau, after Jacob had tricked Isaac into receiving the blessing. Esau begged for a blessing. And this is what Jacob said to Esau. Isaac, his father, answered and said to him, "Behold, your dwelling shall be of the fatness of the earth and of the dew of heaven from above." Verse number 40, "By your sword you shall live." And they would. They were the first one to attack their cousins, the Israelites. And this continued on throughout history. "And you shall serve your brother." That happened under David. "And it shall come to pass when you become restless that you shall break his yoke from your neck." That actually happened too when Babylon invaded Judah. The Edomites helped and conspired with the Babylonians to take over Judah, thus shaking the yoke of Israel from the Edomites' neck. So all of this prophecy was fulfilled. They lived by the sword, they served their brother under David, and they shook the yoke from their brother's neck when the Babylonians conquered Judah. Okay, that's the end of chapter 36. Now we come to chapter 37. We're going to switch from Esau and go to Joseph. Chapter 37, verse number 1. "Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan." Okay, Esau had moved out. He'd gone east. But Jacob is still in the land of Canaan. But notice, he's a stranger there. He hasn't fully inhabited or taken over the land. This word, "he dwelt in the land," where he lived was Hebron, the very southern border of the land of Canaan, going back to chapter 25. And notice, he was a stranger. He was a sojourner. He didn't fully take over the land. His descendants would. The Bible Knowledge Commentary, "In contrast with the expanding, powerful Esau, Jacob was still dwelling in the land of the sojourning of his father, the land of Canaan. Unlike Esau, Jacob had no chiefs or kings yet, no lands given to govern, no full tribes." So Esau becomes powerful, but Jacob would and his descendants later on. Expositors, the writer's point in this verse is to show that the promises of God had not yet completely been fulfilled, and that Jacob, as his fathers before him, was still waiting the fulfillment. It is from such a verse that the New Testament writers read the lives of the patriarchs as aliens and strangers on the earth. Hebrews 11, verse 13. So none of them fully, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, didn't fully possess the promised land. And that's what this verse is emphasizing. Verse number 2. "This is the history of Jacob." Now, this is the 10th time that we've seen this phrase in Genesis from the Hebrew, where it says, "This is the history," and then it has a name. And usually when this happens, it's going to shift to the descendant of this particular individual. So it says, "This is the history of Jacob," but the story is going to switch to Joseph, his son. "This is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old," and this is notable because, as the Nelson Study Bible points out, this is one of the few places in the Bible that the age of a person is given at a certain event. An important event is going to happen, and it actually shows Joseph's age, 17. "Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah, and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. We don't know what the bad report was, but remember that Jacob's other sons weren't of high character quality. In fact, they plundered the city of Shechem, and Simeon and Levi actually killed the males there. So something happened here, and Joseph couldn't stand it, and he reports to the father, to Jacob. Verse number 3. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age. Remember, he loved Rachel, and he loves Joseph. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors. This tunic had great significance in the ancient times. Actually, I'm reading in the New King James tunic. The Old King James translation is coat. And this coat had long sleeves, and it was only worn by the chief and his heir. So in other words, by giving Joseph this tunic, he's saying, you're going to be my principal heir. What do you think that would do to the brothers? It's going to make them upset. Okay, there's even more significance to this. This tunic was a multicolored robe, and it was very costly. And it was worn by the youth of the better class. Jameson Fawcett Brown points that out. The Bible Knowledge Commentary says, this seems to signify that Jacob favored him above the rest with the intent of granting him all or a larger portion of the inheritance. I've been hammering this home throughout Genesis, that inheritance meant everything back in those ancient times. Joseph is one of the youngest sons, and yet he's the one that's going to be granted the largest portion of the inheritance. That's going to make the older brothers inflamed. Also, it's a tunic of many colors. The Companion Bible points out that marks it priestly or royal. Priestly or royal, in other words, to be a king or of royal descent or a priest as well. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says, the passion for many colors still reigns among the Arabs and the country and the country people of the East to have this type of robe of many colors. Verse number 4. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him, because they knew he's going to be granted the large portion of the inheritance. This word hated is repeated 3 times in this section, which shows what they thought of Joseph. I mentioned how the sermon today ties in with chapter 37. Joseph begins to suffer here with his brothers. There was favoritism in the family of Jacob. Remember, number 1, Isaac loved Esau more than Jacob. Also, number 2, Rebekah loved Jacob more than Esau. And number 3, Jacob loved Rachel more than Leah. Now we come along and Israel, Jacob, loves Joseph more than the other sons. Word commentary adds this. His old love for Rachel is now transferred to Joseph, Rachel's son. It's hardly surprising that they hated him, the brothers. Once again, parental attitudes are emerging in the children. Unfortunately, Bible Knowledge Commentary, God confirmed Jacob's choice of his faithful son by 2 dreams. So, the coat of many colors was given to Joseph by Jacob to confirm that he's going to receive the largest portion of the inheritance. But God also confirms that Joseph is God's choice in these dreams that we're going to read. Verse number 5. Joseph had a dream, told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. The old King James says he dreamed a dream. In other words, he had a significant dream, according to the Companion Bible. Verse number 6. So he said to them, to the brothers, please hear this dream which I have dreamed. Verse 7. There we were, binding sheaves in the field, like they would normally do. Then behold, my sheaf rose and stood upright. And indeed, your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. So they're out harvesting, talking about sheaves. He's saying that mine was tall, and all of the other sheaves bowed down around my sheaf. The first dream here is an agricultural scene, hinting that Joseph is going to have authority over his brothers. And of course, we know that is going to happen. Joseph's dreams would come true. These weren't ordinary dreams. They were sent by God as prophecies of what would happen in the future. Verse number 8, and his brother said to him, in a very mocking way, disbelief, shall you indeed reign over us, or shall you indeed have dominion over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. You know, get out of here, Joseph. What are you talking about? You're going to be ruling over us and having authority. And they hated him. Word commentary, despite his brother's incredulity, their words predict exactly what was to happen. Joseph became ruler of all Egypt, chapter 45, verse 8, and next to power to the king, chapter 41, verses 38 through 44. Bible Knowledge Commentary, God's sovereign choice of a leader often brings out the jealousy of those who must submit. You know, God has a way of choosing leaders, and often those around this particular person doesn't understand, and sometimes they don't want to submit. And that's what happens with the brothers, because God did choose Joseph. Verse number 9, he has a second dream. He dreamed another dream, told it to his brothers, and said, look, I've dreamed another dream. And this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me. The second dream was a celestial scene of celestial things in symbol. The sun was Joseph's father, the moon his mother, and the stars has 11 brothers, and they're going to bow down to him. Bible Knowledge Commentary adds this, in ancient cultures, these astronomical symbols represented rulers. The dream then symbolically anticipated the elevation of Joseph over the whole house of Jacob. So in ancient times, they used the sun, the moon, and the stars as symbols of rulership. And this particular dream shows that Joseph is going to rule over the rest of the family. Verse number 10. So he told the dream to his father, not just his brothers this time, but also to Jacob, to his father and his brothers. And his father rebuked him because Jacob didn't understand, you know, what this would all mean. And said to him, what is this dream you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you? So Jacob's a little bit in disbelief. Rebuked here from the Hebrew is not a common word. Word commentary says this is an expression of great authority, often triggered, tinged with anger. So despite his deep affection for Joseph, Jacob feels that this time Joseph has gone too far. That's why he rebuked him. You've gone just a little bit too far, Joseph, with this dream that we're all going to bow down to you. Little did he know that this was prophecy and that it would be fulfilled. Verse 11, and his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. So, envied here from the Hebrew is even stronger than hate, which we've seen three times. And it often leads to violent action, which they're going to take. But Jacob kept the matter in mind, because back in those ancient times, dreams were often a means of revelation. So Jacob was cautious, even though he rebuked him, in case there was actually something to it. That's why he keeps the matter in mind to himself. Verse 12. Then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. So they leave from Hebron and they go north to Shechem. And I'll show you where that's at here shortly. And Israel said to Joseph, Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. So he said, here I am. Shechem, remember, was the city that the sons had conquered by slaughter. It was 50 miles to the north of Hebron. Most likely they took the sheep and the other animals there because Shechem was a good place for watering and a good place for herds. So they go 50 miles north of Hebron, and it was known for its abundance of water and rich pastures. Here's a map. Jacob and the family were in Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had dwelt. And that's right here on the map, down here in the southern part of Canaan. Now the brothers take all the animals north 50 miles to Shechem, again because it was a good place for water and pastures. This was the city of slaughter by Simeon and Levi. 50 miles to the north here. Now Jacob has in mind, okay, wait a minute. That's where they slaughtered the city. And he feared for his sons' lives by the other Canaanite tribes when they found out that the brothers had returned. That's why he's going to send Joseph there to go fetch them back, or to see if that they were okay, is better said. Verse number 14. Then he said to Joseph, please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me. Because again, he was worried that the other Canaanite tribes are going to say, here's these sons that slaughtered our brothers in the city of Shechem. And he was worried about them. So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem. Talking about Joseph. This word well, interestingly, from the Hebrew is shalom, which means not only peace, but to make sure that everything was okay, well, whole and sound with the brothers. That they were okay, in other words. Again, like I've been mentioning, Jacob feared attacks on his sons from other Canaanite tribes. Verse 15. Now a certain man found him, Joseph, and there he was, wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, what are you seeking? So he said, I'm seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks. And the man said, they have departed from here, from Shechem. And I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. He's on a mission from his father to make sure that the brothers are okay. Because they're wandering amongst the other Canaanites now. Dothan, from the Hebrew, means two wells. And it's 12 to 15 miles north of Shechem even. And Dothan was located on a main caravan route from Gilead to Egypt, which is going to be convenient for the brothers as we go through this story. A main caravan route. Verse 18. Now when they, the brothers, saw him, Joseph, afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. So they saw him coming, which he was on a mission from Jacob, and they said, here comes that dreamer, let's kill him. Verse 20, come now therefore, let us kill him, cast him into some pit, and we shall say some wild beast has devoured him. We will see what will become of his dreams. So let's get rid of this dreamer. We're going to kill him off. And we're going to say that animals devoured him to our father. So the brothers devise a plot, as the Bible Knowledge Commentary says, to kill the dreamer in order to prevent his dreams from being fulfilled. That's a good point. They didn't want to bow down to Joseph in the future. So let's get rid of him. Before they plotted to kill many of the Shechemites in order to revenge their sister, going back to chapter 34, now, by contrast, they plot to kill even their own brother. So their character qualities are not very good, the other brothers, unfortunately. The phrase here, kill him, word commentary says, this is what Esau planned to do to Jacob, going back to chapter 27. History repeats itself, especially in Genesis. Verse 21. But Reuben heard it, that they were going to kill him, and delivered him out of their hands, and said, let us not kill him. Reuben, remember, was the oldest brother. He intervenes and says, let's not kill him. Verse 22, Reuben said to them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness. Do not lay a hand on him, that he, Reuben, might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. So Reuben is the only one of the brothers that has mercy. And his idea is, let's not kill him. Let's cast him into a well pit. And Reuben was planning on taking him back to Jacob, safe and sound. A pit is a dry well or a cistern. And Reuben intervenes so that Joseph is not killed, to hopefully bring him back to his father. Here's what one of those dry pits, wells, would have looked like without the ladder. They cast him into this. Some of the commentaries point out that if this was dry, it was probably moldy and musty and smelly down there. And he's cast down in there without a way out. There was no ladder, of course. Again, we see the beginning of Joseph's sufferings. His brothers want to kill him. He's cast into this pit. Then we go on even further into the story. So it came to pass, verse 23, when Joseph had come to his brothers, they stripped Joseph of his tunic, which signified the inheritance, the tunic of many colors that was on him. Then they took him, cast him into the pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it. Word commentary points out the succession of these verbs. Stripped him of the tunic, took him, cast him, conveys the speed and the roughness of the brother's assault on Joseph. So this was a terrible thing that they were doing. And it just shows the action and how violent it was to Joseph from the brothers. Verse 25, and they, you know, real content now that they've dealt with their brother, they sat down to eat a meal. And they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites. Who is it? Who is the Ishmaelites? Descendants of Ishmael, Abraham's son, coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing spices, balm, and myrrh, on their way to carry them to Egypt. Because these were riches that they were taking to Egypt, all these spices, etc. Dothan, as I mentioned before, was located conveniently to a main trade route. It was east of the Sea of Galilee, and it was known for its balm. The Ishmaelites are descendants of Abraham's son Ishmael. Remember, we've said this, and we've established that the Arabians, the descendants of Ishmael, had been known for their caravans of trade. That's what these Ishmaelites are doing. They're traders, and they're taking valuable spices, etc., to Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, what profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? So Judah, and this kind of goes through the history of the Jews, he's thinking of the profit of this. If we just kill him, we're not going to make anything out of this deal. Let's sell him and make some money. Come, this is Judah's idea, verse 27, and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. And let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh. And his brothers listened. Verse 28, then Midianite traders passed by. So the brothers pulled Joseph up, lifted him out of the pit, and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. I've got a map here for you. This is a map that shows the modern countries in the Middle East today. There's Syria, where the war is going on today, where the Russians are bombing. Here's Iraq. And down here is Jordan. The southern part of Jordan is where Edom is located. Here is where the Midianites were located, to the east of Arabia. And down here is the Ishmaelites. They were next door neighbors in Arabia. The Ishmaelites and Midianites are both descended from Abraham. The question often comes up because of verse 28, some people ask, okay, wait a minute, was he sold to Ishmaelite traders or Midianite traders? Because it mentions both of them here. Ishmael and Midian were both descended from Abraham. The Midianites through Keturah, going back to chapter 25, and Ishmael through Hagar, chapter 16. Ishmael and Midian were half-brothers, and they were half-brothers to Isaac as well. So what's happening here is the brothers are going to sell Joseph to their cousins and have them take, he'd be sold to Egypt, in Egypt. So what we see from verse 28 is these traders are either second or third cousins of Joseph and his brothers. So he says here, come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. Let us, our hand not be upon him, for he's our brother in our flesh. And then Midianite traders passed by, and they pulled Joseph up, lifted him out of the pit, sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. So he's already suffered in the fact that his brothers hated him, stripped him of his tunic, treated him very badly, shoved him down into this pit. Now they sell him to their cousins, the Ishmaelites, Midianites. And he's going to be taken as a slave to Egypt. This is just the beginning of his suffering. I know you've seen some of the pictures from like Ben-Hur, movie pictures, etc. These slaves were not treated very well. Most times they were shackled, and they weren't treated very well along the way. This is the picture of what we could get of Joseph amongst these slave traders going to Egypt. Ishmaelites and Midianites were often mixed together. They were known to travel and work together, even intermarry between the two tribes. And again, Midianites were sons of Abraham through Keturah. He was sold for 20 shekels of silver, which was the price of a young male slave in the ancient times. Verse 29, and we're coming to the end of the chapter now. Then Reuben, remember he was going to return Joseph to his father. That was his plan. Reuben returned to the pit, and indeed Joseph was not in the pit, and he tore his clothes. And he returned to his brothers and said, the lad is no more, and I, where shall I go? Then they took Joseph's tunic. Here's their plot. They killed a kid of the goats, dipped the tunic in the blood. Then they sent the tunic of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, we have found this. Of course, they're lying. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not? So they tried to make it like an animal had killed Joseph, and here's the blood on the tunic. And Jacob, recognized it and said, it is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. That was his conclusion. Without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces. Verse 34, then Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, for I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning. Thus his father wept for him, because he loved Joseph. Bible Knowledge Commentary. The theme of deception again surfaced in the family. Here Jacob was deceived once again, this time by his own sons. The use of goat's blood is ironic, for the skins of a goat were used by Jacob to deceive his father. So, as the old saying goes, what goes around comes around, because he's deceived by his own sons by using goat's blood. Word Commentary adds this, the mention of three aspects of Jacob's grief, tearing of his clothes, the wearing of sackcloth, and the mourning many days underlined the intensity of his grief. So he was in terrible, terrible mourning for Joseph. Verse 35, this is a question that comes up. It says all of his daughters also comfort him. But there's not any daughters mentioned except for Dinah in Genesis. But this is put for all the female relatives and granddaughters that Jacob had, according to the Companion Bible. Finally, we come to verse 36, the last verse of the chapter. Now the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. So all the suffering that Joseph had gone through, he's beginning. Potiphar here means he whom Re, the sun god, S-U-N god, has given. And he's captain of the palace guard. So this is where we're going to take off the next time in chapter 38. He's sold by the Midianites in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. And he finds himself in the land of Egypt. That's the end of chapter 37. Again, but before we leave, let's take a look at some lessons from these chapters today. First of all, we see that Esau was not the inheritor of the blessings, but he was not forgotten. He became a powerful chief, and his descendants a nation, the Edomites. So Isaac's promises to Esau were fulfilled. Jacob, he had to wait while Esau was becoming a powerful chief in a powerful nation. Lesson number two, a promised spiritual blessing is dependent upon patience and faith. Having to wait while others prosper is a test of patience and faithfulness. And that's a good lesson for all of us as disciples. God makes promises to us, but he doesn't always fulfill them right away. It's a test of patience and faithfulness. You know, again, Esau became powerful right away. Jacob never did inherit the land, but he knows what lays out in the future. Joseph, we see, was mistreated by his brothers. Lesson number three, suffering is a test of character. Talked about that in the sermon today. Even though Joseph was of upright character, he was not kept from suffering, just like Job. And Joseph learns lessons out of it as well. Here's a prophecy from Genesis chapter 15, verses 13 and 14, which is going to lead me to lesson number four. God said to Abram, "Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that's not theirs, and will serve them, and they, the Egyptians, will afflict them for 400 years. Verse 14, also the nation whom they serve I will judge, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions." God gave this promise to Abraham way back in Genesis chapter 15, that his descendants are going to go to Egypt, they're going to serve the Egyptians, they're going to be afflicted, but after that, he's going to judge the Egyptians by the plagues, and they're going to come out with a high hand and with great possessions. And of course, in Genesis chapter 37, we see, lesson number four, how God brings that prophecy to pass. He took an existing situation, Jacob's favoritism and the brothers' jealousy, and with Joseph's dreams, he steers events toward his ultimate plan, Israel to Egypt, and eventually the Exodus. So even though all these things were happening that seemed to be bad for Joseph, it was part of God's plan. He brought prophecy to fulfillment while allowing those involved to make their own decisions along the way. So those are some lessons for us from these two chapters. Any questions or comments? No? Okay, everybody must be hungry. All right, well, we'll close then the Bible study.